The global demand for fish is increasing. In fact, fish ranks as one of the most highly traded food commodities. Yet, global fish stocks have long been under threat from overfishing and illegal fishing.
It's really popular. So when it's a barramundi, as a fish of the day, it gets sold out pretty quickly.
As the population grows and fish stocks disappear, the aquaculture industry has stepped in to bridge the gap.
Aquaculture is the farming of any aquatic organism. And this farming can be for and is primarily for food production.
That's Professor Dean Jerry. He's the director of the Australian Research Council's research hub for supercharging tropical aquaculture. He says it's the fastest growing food sector globally, and if done well, will be more sustainable than wild fishing.
It is more sustainable, absolutely, in the sense that we have a lot more control over the levels of production, and we're not necessarily just blindly fishing out in the oceans, whether it's trawling or using gill nets, which often will capture also a lot of bycatch or non-target organisms.
But aquaculture has had its fair share of critics since it took off commercially about 50 years ago. Wastewater runoff can pollute the surrounding water and diseases can spread quickly. It's led to the use of antibiotics and chemicals. Sajjad Akloggi owns a sustainable seafood eatery in Sydney. He doesn't sell farmed fish at all.
The taste is completely different, even the look of them is completely different. The type of food they give the fish is not the natural food and is also obviously not in its natural environment. So it's always going to be stressed.
But Professor Jerry says tight environmental regulations are making sure Australia's aquaculture sector is sustainable. He says a lot of work has been done in recent years to combat some of the challenges the industry faces. This includes reducing the amount of wild caught fish used to make feed known as fishmeal for predators such as salmon.
Over the last 15, 20 years, a lot of research has been done which now has really lowered the amount of fishmeal input as a percentage of those total nutrients that go into, say, the pelleted diet for our species.
Though he says that can't be said for the global industry. Despite Australia producing high-quality seafood, it's estimated around 70% of seafood eaten is imported, predominantly from Asia.
The issue here for Australia is that we are a high-cost economy. We have high labour costs and high input costs. We have tight environmental regulation. We have very sustainable practices where we limit the use of, say, antibiotics and certain chemicals. Whereas some of the product that is imported in from Asia, China, for instance, or Vietnam, does not have that tight restrictions and therefore, you know, from a human health perspective, actually may not be as nutritious as our locally produced products.
Pepper and salt on the pan. Then I'll throw on the skin side first.
Scott Spilius is a PhD student at the University of Queensland. He's been studying the role of seaweed in aquaculture and says growing seaweed could mitigate issues associated with fish farms, such as combating wastewater runoff.
So there's a lot of people interested in growing things like seaweeds and bivalves alongside those fish farms so that the seaweeds and the bivalves can absorb the nutrients. And so then you've kind of got this win-win where you're creating this other product at the same time as you're reducing the environmental impact.
The other products he's talking about include livestock feed, biofuels, and even new foods such as plant-based proteins.
So in the same way that we use corn and soy, terrestrial crops, to produce new kind of foods or synthesize new kind of future foods, we could be using seaweeds in kind of a similar way. And so in that way, it might be that we start to find seaweed in our cropping up in our diets in ways that we might not expect.
Despite the challenges, Mr. Spilius is hopeful the aquaculture industry can provide a sustainable source of food.
The ocean's really already in trouble in terms of a lot of the negative impacts. So, you know, should we be asking more from the ocean? That's a tough question to ask, but I think there's a lot of potential, and it could be, if we do it correctly, then I think we could be producing more, but also in a regenerative way.
The global demand for fish is increasing. In fact, fish ranks as one of the most highly traded food commodities. Yet, global fish stocks have long been under threat from overfishing and illegal fishing.
It's really popular. So when it's a barramundi, as a fish of the day, it gets sold out pretty quickly.
As the population grows and fish stocks disappear, the aquaculture industry has stepped in to bridge the gap.
Aquaculture is the farming of any aquatic organism. And this farming can be for and is primarily for food production.
That's Professor Dean Jerry. He's the director of the Australian Research Council's research hub, the Supercharging Tropical Aquaculture. He says it's the fastest growing food sector globally, and if done well, will be more sustainable than wild fishing.
It is more sustainable, absolutely, in the sense that we have a lot more control over the levels of production, and we're not necessarily just blindly fishing out in the oceans, whether it's trawling or using gill nets, which often will capture also a lot of bycatch or non-target organisms.
But aquaculture has had its fair share of critics since it took off commercially about 50 years ago. Wastewater runoff can pollute the surrounding water and diseases can spread quickly. It's led to the use of antibiotics and chemicals. Sajjad Akloggi owns a sustainable seafood eatery in Sydney. He doesn't sell farmed fish at all.
The taste is completely different, even the look of them is completely different. The type of food they give the fish is not the natural food and is also obviously not in its natural environment. So it's always going to be stress.
But Professor Jerry says tight environmental regulations are making sure Australia's aquaculture sector is sustainable. He says a lot of work has been done in recent years to combat some of the challenges the industry faces. This includes reducing the amount of wild caught fish used to make feed known as fishmeal for predators such as salmon.
Over the last 15, 20 years, a lot of research has been done which now has really lowered the amount of fishmeal input as a percentage of the total nutrients that go into, say, the pelleted diet for our species.
Though he says that can't be said for the global industry. Despite Australia producing high-quality seafood, it's estimated around 70% of seafood eaten is imported, predominantly from Asia.
The issue here for Australia is that we are a high-cost economy. We have high labour costs and high input costs. We have tight environmental regulation. We have very sustainable practices where we limit the use of, say, antibiotics and certain chemicals. Whereas some of the product that is imported in from Asia, China, for instance, or Vietnam, does not have that tight restrictions and therefore, you know, from a human health perspective, actually may not be as nutritious as our locally produced product.
Pepper and salt on the pan. Then I throw on the skin side first.
Scott Spilius is a PhD student at the University of Queensland. He's been studying the role of seaweed in aquaculture and says growing seaweed could mitigate issues associated with fish farms, such as combating wastewater runoff.
So there's a lot of people interested in growing things like seaweeds and bivalves alongside those fish farms so that the seaweeds and the bivalves can absorb the nutrients. And so then you've kind of got this win-win where you're creating this other product at the same time as you're reducing the environmental impact.
The other products he's talking about include livestock feed, biofuels, and even new foods such as plant-based proteins.
So in the same way that we use corn and soy, terrestrial crops, to produce new kind of foods or synthesize new kind of future foods, we could be using seaweeds in kind of a similar way. And so in that way, it might be that we start to find seaweed in our cropping up in our diets in ways that we might not expect.
Despite the challenges, Mr. Spilius is hopeful the aquaculture industry can provide a sustainable source of food.
The ocean's really already in trouble in terms of a lot of the negative impacts. So, you know, should we be asking more from the ocean? That's a tough question to ask, but I think there's a lot of potential, and it could be, if we do it correctly, then I think we could be producing more, but also in a regenerative way.
The global demand for fish is increasing. In fact, fish ranks as one of the most highly traded food commodities. Yet, global fish stocks have long been under threat from overfishing and illegal fishing.
It's really popular. So when it's a barramundi as a fish of the day, it gets sold out pretty quickly.
As the population grows and fish stocks disappear, the aquaculture industry has stepped in to bridge the gap.
Aquaculture is the farming of any aquatic organism, and this farming can be for and is primarily for food production.
That's Professor Dean Jerry. He's the director of the Australian Research Council's research hub for Supercharging Tropical Aquaculture. He says it's the fastest growing food sector globally, and if done well, will be more sustainable than wild fishing.
It is more sustainable, absolutely, in the sense that we have a lot more control over the levels of production, and we're not necessarily just blindly fishing out in the oceans, whether it's trawling or using gill nets, which often will capture also a lot of bycatch or non-target organisms.
But aquaculture has had its fair share of critics since it took off commercially about 50 years ago. Wastewater runoff can pollute the surrounding water and diseases can spread quickly. It's led to the use of antibiotics and chemicals. Sajjad Akloggi owns a sustainable seafood eatery in Sydney. He doesn't sell farmed fish at all.
The taste is completely different, even the look of them is completely different. The type of food they give the fish is not the natural food and is also obviously not in its natural environment. So it's always going to be stress.
But Professor Jerry says tight environmental regulations are making sure Australia's aquaculture sector is sustainable. He says a lot of work has been done in recent years to combat some of the challenges the industry faces. This includes reducing the amount of wild caught fish used to make feed known as fishmeal for predators such as salmon.
Over the last 15, 20 years, a lot of research has been done which now has really lowered the amount of fishmeal input as a percentage of the total nutrients that go into, say, the pelleted diet for our species.
Though he says that can't be said for the global industry. Despite Australia producing high-quality seafood, it's estimated around 70% of seafood eaten is imported, predominantly from Asia.
The issue here for Australia is that we are a high-cost economy. We have high labour costs and high input costs. We have tight environmental regulation. We have very sustainable practices where we limit the use of, say, antibiotics and certain chemicals. Whereas some of the product that is imported in from Asia, China, for instance, or Vietnam, does not have that tight restrictions and therefore, you know, from a human health perspective, actually may not be as nutritious as our locally produced product.
Pepper and salt on the pan. Then I'll throw on the skin side first.
Scott Spilius is a PhD student at the University of Queensland. He's been studying the role of seaweed in aquaculture and says growing seaweed could mitigate issues associated with fish farms, such as combating wastewater runoff.
So there's a lot of people interested in growing things like seaweeds and bivalves alongside those fish farms so that the seaweeds and the bivalves can absorb the nutrients. And so then you've kind of got this win-win where you're creating this other product at the same time as you're reducing the environmental impact.
The other products he's talking about include livestock feed, biofuels, and even new foods such as plant-based proteins.
So in the same way that we use corn and soy, terrestrial crops, to produce new kind of foods or synthesize new kind of future foods, we could be using seaweeds in kind of a similar way. And so in that way, it might be that we start to find seaweed in our cropping up in our diets in ways that we might not expect.
Despite the challenges, Mr. Spilius is hopeful the aquaculture industry can provide a sustainable source of food.
The ocean's really already in trouble in terms of a lot of the negative impacts. So, you know, should we be asking more from the ocean? That's a tough question to ask, but I think there's a lot of potential, and it could be, if we do it correctly, then I think we could be producing more, but also in a regenerative way.
Cryptocurrencies have been touted as the future of finance. Now they are in crisis. Bitcoin is floundering after a sharp sell-off, and of course there's the fallout from the catastrophic collapse of the cryptocurrency exchange FTX, which now is spreading. NPR's David Gura joins me. And David, I want to start with FTX. Everybody's talking about it. What does it actually tell us about the wider state of crypto?
Well, for one thing, it tells us how much has changed. I mean, just go back to the beginning of last year when crypto was being marketed as the next big thing with these marquee endorsements and Super Bowl ads. Well, now FTX has imploded, and that's raising questions about this whole industry, because this company that had name recognition and a global footprint is now at the center of what's allegedly one of the largest frauds in history. So FTX's collapse is shaping the public sense of what crypto is, Mary Louise, and that's not going to change as we learn more about the company's downfall, as its former CEO fights criminal charges and as FTX, under new leadership, goes through bankruptcy proceedings.
Yeah, stay with where everything stands in court for a second. What's the latest?
Yeah, so Sam Bankman-Fried recently pleaded not guilty to 8 criminal charges, and if he's convicted at trial, which is scheduled to start in October, Bankman-Fried could spend the rest of his life in prison. Federal prosecutors are building their case on hundreds of thousands of documents they say will shed light on how Bankman-Fried's crypto empire operated. Then, in Delaware, in bankruptcy court, more than 1 million creditors, including many FTX customers, are trying to recover money that's gone missing. Remember, what's alleged is that Bankman-Fried misused customer money, and one thing he's accused of is using it to cover losses when cryptocurrency prices cratered. So as prosecutors and investigators uncover more, we're going to get new details on how interconnected the world of crypto is, and also how much this sector has evaded scrutiny.
I said when I introduced you that the fallout from the collapse of FTX is spreading. How so?
Yeah, there is going to be more scrutiny. We're going to see more about that. Law enforcement will come down harder on cryptocurrency companies going forward. And keep in mind, many first-time investors lost money buying Bitcoin and other digital currencies when they peaked. There's fear other crypto companies may crash and burn. Alkesh Shah is a strategist at Bank of America, and he says the industry just can't continue as is. For one thing, there are too many tokens, too many different kinds of cryptocurrencies.
So if you take a step back, there's about 22,000 tokens traded on about 170 exchanges globally. And most of those tokens have virtually no intrinsic value.
Shah expects maybe 50 of them will be viable after this reset. So just think about that, Mary Louise. He predicts we'll go from 22,000 different kinds of cryptocurrency to just 50.
Yeah, that's quite the change in terms of the number of cryptocurrencies we may be looking at. What about their value? What is Wall Street expecting?
Well, the so-called crypto winter shows no signs of thawing. It's a downturn that kicked off when the Federal Reserve started hiking interest rates to fight high inflation and investors lost their appetite for risk. Bitcoin fell by about 60% last year. Madeline Hume is an analyst from Morningstar. And she says we may be in the bleakest days of that crypto winter, and pessimism is pervasive.
It's been cold for so long. There are no more holidays or ski vacations to look forward to, and there's no end in sight.
Bitcoin is up slightly 9 days into the new year, trading at around $17,000, Mary Louise, but that is still a far cry from its all-time high of about $69,000. And that's not ancient history. Bitcoin set that record just over a year ago.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
And NPR's David Gura. Cryptocurrencies have been touted as the future of finance. Now they are in crisis. Bitcoin is floundering after a sharp sell-off, and of course there's the fallout from the catastrophic collapse of the cryptocurrency exchange FTX, which now is spreading. NPR's David Gura joins me. And David, I want to start with FTX. Everybody's talking about it. What does it actually tell us about the wider state of crypto?
Well, for one thing, it tells us how much has changed. I mean, just go back to the beginning of last year when crypto was being marketed as the next big thing with these marquee endorsements and Super Bowl ads. Well, now FTX has imploded, and that's raising questions about this whole industry, because this company that had name recognition and a global footprint is now at the center of what's allegedly one of the largest frauds in history. So FTX's collapse is shaping the public sense of what crypto is, Mary Louise, and that's not going to change as We learn more about the company's downfall as its former CEO fights criminal charges and as FTX, under new leadership, goes through bankruptcy proceedings.
Yeah, stay with where everything stands in court for a second. What's the latest?
Yeah, so Sam Bankman-Fried recently pleaded not guilty to 8 criminal charges, and if he's convicted at trial, which is scheduled to start in October, Bankman-Fried could spend the rest of his life in prison. Federal prosecutors are building their case on hundreds of thousands of documents they say will shed light on how Bankman-Fried's crypto empire operated. Then, in Delaware, in bankruptcy court, more than 1 million creditors, including many FTX customers, are trying to recover money that's gone missing. Remember, what's alleged is that Bankman-Fried misused customer money, and one thing he's accused of is using it to cover losses when cryptocurrency prices cratered. So as prosecutors and investigators uncover more, we're going to get new details on how interconnected the world of crypto is, and also how much this sector has evaded scrutiny.
I said when I introduced you that the fallout from the collapse of FTX is spreading. How so?
Yeah, there is going to be more scrutiny. We're going to see more about that. Law enforcement will come down harder on cryptocurrency companies going forward. And keep in mind, many first-time investors lost money buying Bitcoin and other digital currencies when they peaked. There's fear other crypto companies may crash and burn. Alkesh Shah is a strategist at Bank of America, and he says the industry just can't continue as is. For one thing, there are too many tokens, too many different kinds of cryptocurrencies.
So if you take a step back, there's about 22,000 tokens traded on about 170 exchanges globally. And most of those tokens have virtually no intrinsic value.
Shah expects maybe 50 of them will be viable after this reset. So just think about that, Mary Louise. He predicts we'll go from 22,000 different kinds of cryptocurrency to just 50.
Yeah, that's quite the change in terms of the number of cryptocurrencies we may be looking at. What about their value? What is Wall Street expecting?
Well, the so-called crypto winter shows no signs of thawing. It's a downturn that kicked off when the Federal Reserve started hiking interest rates to fight high inflation and investors lost their appetite for risk. Bitcoin fell by about 60% last year. Madeline Hume is an analyst from Morningstar. And she says we may be in the bleakest days of that crypto winter, and pessimism is pervasive.
It's been cold for so long. There are no more holidays or ski vacations to look forward to, and there's no end in sight.
Bitcoin is up slightly 9 days into the new year, trading at around $17,000, Mary Louise, but that is still a far cry from its all-time high of about $69,000. And that's not ancient history. Bitcoin set that record just over a year ago.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
And NPR's David Gura. Cryptocurrencies have been touted as the future of finance. Now they are in crisis. Bitcoin is floundering after a sharp sell-off, and of course there's the fallout from the catastrophic collapse of the cryptocurrency exchange FTX, which now is spreading. NPR's David Gura joins me. And David, I want to start with FTX. Everybody's talking about it. What does it actually tell us about the wider state of crypto?
Well, for one thing, it tells us how much has changed. I mean, just go back to the beginning of last year when crypto was being marketed as the next big thing with these marquee endorsements and Super Bowl ads. Well, now FTX has imploded, and that's raising questions about this whole industry, because this company that had name recognition and a global footprint is now at the center of what's allegedly one of the largest frauds in history. So FTX's collapse is shaping the public sense of what crypto is, Mary Louise, and that's not going to change as we learn more about the company's downfall as its former CEO fights criminal charges and as FTX, under new leadership, goes through bankruptcy proceedings.
Yeah, stay with where everything stands in court for a second. What's the latest?
Yeah, so Sam Bankman-Fried recently pleaded not guilty to 8 criminal charges, and if he's convicted at trial, which is scheduled to start in October, Bankman-Fried could spend the rest of his life in prison. Federal prosecutors are building their case on hundreds of thousands of documents they say will shed light on how Bankman-Fried's crypto empire operated. Then, in Delaware, in bankruptcy court, more than 1 million creditors, including many FTX customers, are trying to recover money that's gone missing. Remember, what's alleged is that Bankman-Fried misused customer money, and one thing he's accused of is using it to cover losses when cryptocurrency prices cratered. So as prosecutors and investigators uncover more, we're going to get new details on how interconnected the world of crypto is, and also how much this sector has evaded scrutiny.
I said when I introduced you that the fallout from the collapse of FTX is spreading. How so?
Yeah, there is going to be more scrutiny. We're going to see more about that. Law enforcement will come down harder on cryptocurrency companies going forward. And keep in mind, many first-time investors lost money buying Bitcoin and other digital currencies when they peaked. There's fear other crypto companies may crash and burn. Alka Shah is a strategist at Bank of America, and he says the industry just can't continue as is. For one thing, there are too many tokens, too many different kinds of cryptocurrencies.
So if you take a step back, there's about 22,000 tokens traded on about 170 exchanges globally. And most of those tokens have virtually no intrinsic value.
Shah expects maybe 50 of them will be viable after this reset. So just think about that, Mary Louise. He predicts we'll go from 22,000 different kinds of cryptocurrency to just 50.
Yeah, that's quite the change in terms of the number of cryptocurrencies we may be looking at. What about their value? What is Wall Street expecting?
Well, the so-called crypto winter shows no signs of thawing. It's a downturn that kicked off when the Federal Reserve started hiking interest rates to fight high inflation and investors lost their appetite for risk. Bitcoin fell by about 60% last year. Madeline Hume is an analyst for Morningstar. And she says we may be in the bleakest days of that crypto winter, and pessimism is pervasive.
It's been cold for so long. There are no more holidays or ski vacations to look forward to, and there's no end in sight.
Bitcoin is up slightly 9 days into the new year, trading at around $17,000, Mary Louise, but that is still a far cry from its all-time high of about $69,000. And that's not ancient history. Bitcoin set that record just over a year ago.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
And NPR's David Gura.
Bran Castle. In the center of Romania is a medieval castle believed to have once held a very famous or infamous prisoner, Vlad Tepes Dracula, aka Vlad the Impaler. The infamous Romanian ruler was immortalized as the inspiration for Bram Stoker's Dracula. Bran Castle was built between 1377 and 1388 atop a strategic site overlooking a heavily trafficked mountain pass between Transylvania and Wallachia, the land over which Vlad the Impaler ruled in the 15th century. Bran Castle is owned by the descendants of Queen Marie after it was given to them as a token of appreciation for her efforts to unify Romania. After her death, Bran Castle was inherited by her daughter, Princess Ileana, who ran it as a hospital during World War II. In 1948, the castle was seized by the communist regime, but it was returned to Dominic von Habsburg, Princess Ileana's son, in 2006. But now that the dust is settled, Bran Castle is open as a museum. Peña National Palace. Perched high atop a lush hill in São Pedro de Penaferim, Portugal. Built in the 19th century by King Ferdinand II, the palace was meant to be a summer home for the Portuguese royals. One portion would resemble a medieval European castle, complete with ornate parapets. Then the portion directly next to it would be modeled after an Islamic tower dome.
Each section of the facade was also presented in a different color. A long purple wing is flanked by a red clock tower, a yellow minaret, and so on. It's said that Ferdinand wanted the place to look like an opera, but today it's seen as not one of the greatest, but certainly the grandest examples of Romantic architecture. The interior of the palace was no less opulent or eclectic. Many of the rooms were designed to reflect a certain cultural influence, ranging from Middle Eastern styles to the European Baroque. When the royal family fled Portugal during the Revolution of 1910, the palace and its grounds were abandoned and fell into disrepair. Thankfully, though, the site was restored later in the 20th century and is now classified as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. The palace can now be visited by anyone willing to make the trek, king or not, and it's well worth it since visitors get to experience the whole world of architecture in one stop. Corvin Castle. In the heart of Transylvania, Dracula's favorite, one of Europe's largest castles looks like it sits atop a rocky bluff with nothing but a thin bridge allowing access. This is Corvin Castle, which looks like something straight out of a dark fairy tale, largely because that's what the restorers wanted. Built in the mid-15th century, the castle was the work of military leader John Hunyadi, who constructed the tall structure over the remains of a keep built by Charles I. Corvin Castle is split into three large areas, the Knight's Hall, the Diet Hall, and the circular stairways. Each of these three parts is surrounded by both circular and rectangular towers that were used for both defenses and a prison. The elaborate architecture was designed in a rich Gothic style that accentuates the already impressive structure. It wasn't until the 17th century that there was more interest in restoring this medieval castle. As the reconstruction began, the workers redesigned it to reflect what they considered a Gothic castle should look like, which explains much of its currently fanciful look. A number of legends are also associated with the castle, too. Though this is unlikely, tourists are told that Vlad the Impaler spent some 7 years in the dungeons of Corvin Castle, a stay that resulted in his eventual madness. Quinta da Regalera. Quinta da Regalera is a UNESCO World Heritage Site in Sintra, Portugal, designed by Carvalho Monteiro. Italian architect Luigi Manini designed the 10-hectare estate with its enigmatic buildings, believed to hide symbols related to alchemy, masonry, the Knights Templar, and the Rosicrucians. Who knows what sort of eldritch secrets are hidden within these beautiful stone walls? The architecture of the palace evokes Roman, Gothic, Renaissance, and Manueline architecture styles. The construction of the current estate commenced in 1904, and most of it was concluded by 1910. The gardens are incredibly and equally ornate as well. Set on a hillside, a multitude of fountains, grottos, statues, caves, and ponds are all connected both above ground via lovely paths and by a series of underground tunnels lit today by strings of fairy lights. The grounds also include a chapel and an aquarium built to look as if it naturally existed amongst the rock. Bran Castle. In the center of Romania is a medieval castle believed to have once held a very famous or infamous prisoner, Vlad Tepes Dracula, aka Vlad the Impaler. The infamous Romanian ruler was immortalized as the inspiration for Bram Stoker's Dracula. Bran Castle was built between 1377 and 1388 atop a strategic site overlooking a heavily trafficked mountain pass between Transylvania and Wallachia, the land over which Vlad the Impaler ruled in the 15th century. Bran Castle is owned by the descendants of Queen Marie after it was given to them as a token of appreciation for her efforts to unify Romania. After her death, Bran Castle was inherited by her daughter, Princess Ileana, who ran it as a hospital during World War II. In 1948, the castle was seized by the communist regime, but it was returned to Dominic von Habsburg, Princess Ileana's son, in 2006. But now that the dust is settled, Bran Castle is open as a museum. Peña National Palace. Perched high atop a lush hill in São Pedro de Penaferim, Portugal. Built in the 19th century by King Ferdinand II, the palace was meant to be a summer home for the Portuguese royals. One portion would resemble a medieval European castle, complete with ornate parapets. Then the portion directly next to it would be modeled after an Islamic tower dome. Each section of the facade was also presented in a different color. A long purple wing is flanked by a red clock tower, a yellow minaret, and so on. It said that Ferdinand wanted the place to look like an opera, but today it's seen as not one of the greatest, but certainly the grandest examples of Romantic architecture. The interior of the palace was no less opulent or eclectic. Many of the rooms were designed to reflect a certain cultural influence, ranging from Middle Eastern styles to the European Baroque. When the royal family fled Portugal during the Revolution of 1910, the palace and its grounds were abandoned and fell into disrepair. Thankfully, though, the site was restored later in the 20th century and is now classified as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. The palace can now be visited by anyone willing to make the trek, king or not, and it's well worth it since visitors get to experience the whole world of architecture in one stop. Corvin Castle. In the heart of Transylvania, Dracula's favorite, one of Europe's largest castles looks like it sits atop a rocky bluff with nothing but a thin bridge allowing access. This is Corvin Castle, which looks like something straight out of a dark fairy tale, largely because that's what the restorers wanted. Built in the mid-15th century, the castle was the work of military leader John Hunyadi, who constructed the tall structure over the remains of a keep built by Charles I. Corvin Castle is split into three large areas, the Knight's Hall, the Diet Hall, and the circular stairways. Each of these three parts is surrounded by both circular and rectangular towers that were used for both defenses and a prison. The elaborate architecture was designed in a rich Gothic style that accentuates the already impressive structure. It wasn't until the 17th century that there was more interest in restoring this medieval castle. As the reconstruction began, the workers redesigned it to reflect what they considered a Gothic castle should look like, which explains much of its currently fanciful look. A number of legends are also associated with the castle, too. Though this is unlikely, tourists are told that Vlad the Impaler spent some 7 years in the dungeons of Corvin Castle, a stay that resulted in his eventual madness. Quinta da Regalera. Quinta da Regalera is a UNESCO World Heritage Site in Sintra, Portugal, designed by Carvalho Monteiro. Italian architect Luigi Manini designed the 10-hectare estate with its enigmatic buildings, believed to hide symbols related to alchemy, masonry, the Knights Templar, and the Rosicrucians. Who knows what sort of eldritch secrets are hidden within these beautiful stone walls? The architecture of the palace evokes Roman, Gothic, Renaissance, and Manueline architecture styles. The construction of the current estate commenced in 1904, and most of it was concluded by 1910. The gardens are incredibly and equally ornate as well. Set on a hillside, a multitude of fountains, grottos, statues, caves, and ponds are all connected both above ground via lovely paths and by a series of underground tunnels lit today by strings of fairy lights. The grounds also include a chapel and an aquarium built to look as if it naturally existed amongst the rock. Bran Castle. In the center of Romania is a medieval castle believed to have once held a very famous or infamous prisoner, Vlad Tepes Dracula, aka Vlad the Impaler. The infamous Romanian ruler was immortalized as the inspiration for Bram Stoker's Dracula. Bran Castle was built between 1377 and 1388 atop a strategic site overlooking a heavily trafficked mountain pass between Transylvania and Wallachia, the land over which Vlad the Impaler ruled in the 15th century. Bran Castle is owned by the descendants of Queen Marie after it was given to them as a token of appreciation for her efforts to unify Romania. After her death, Bran Castle was inherited by her daughter, Princess Ileana, who ran it as a hospital during World War II. In 1948, the castle was seized by the communist regime, but it was returned to Dominic von Habsburg, Princess Ileana's son, in 2006. But now that the dust is settled, Bran Castle is open as a museum. Peña National Palace. Perched high atop a lush hill in São Pedro de Penaferim, Portugal. Built in the 19th century by King Ferdinand II, the palace was meant to be a summer home for the Portuguese royals. One portion would resemble a medieval European castle, complete with ornate parapets. Then the portion directly next to it would be modeled after an Islamic tower dome. Each section of the facade was also presented in a different color. A long purple wing is flanked by a red clock tower, a yellow minaret, and so on. It's said that Ferdinand wanted the place to look like an opera, but today it's seen as not one of the greatest, but certainly the grandest examples of Romantic architecture. The interior of the palace was no less opulent or eclectic. Many of the rooms were designed to reflect a certain cultural influence, ranging from Middle Eastern styles to the European Baroque. When the royal family fled Portugal during the Revolution of 1910, the palace and its grounds were abandoned and fell into disrepair. Thankfully, though, the site was restored later in the 20th century and is now classified as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. The palace can now be visited by anyone willing to make the trek, king or not, and it's well worth it since visitors get to experience the whole world of architecture in one stop. Corvin Castle. In the heart of Transylvania, Dracula's favorite, one of Europe's largest castles looks like it sits atop a rocky bluff with nothing but a thin bridge allowing access. This is Corvin Castle, which looks like something straight out of a dark fairy tale, largely because that's what the restorers wanted. Built in the mid-15th century, the castle was the work of military leader John Hunyadi, who constructed the tall structure over the remains of a keep built by Charles I. Corvin Castle is split into three large areas, the Knight's Hall, the Diet Hall, and the circular stairways. Each of these three parts is surrounded by both circular and rectangular towers that were used for both defenses and a prison. The elaborate architecture was designed in a rich Gothic style that accentuates the already impressive structure. It wasn't until the 17th century that there was more interest in restoring this medieval castle. As the reconstruction began, the workers redesigned it to reflect what they considered a Gothic castle should look like, which explains much of its currently fanciful look. A number of legends are also associated with the castle, too. Though this is unlikely, tourists are told that Vlad the Impaler spent some 7 years in the dungeons of Corvin Castle, a stay that resulted in his eventual madness. Quinta da Regalera. Quinta da Regalera is a UNESCO World Heritage Site in Sintra, Portugal, designed by Carvalho Monteiro. Italian architect Luigi Manini designed the 10-hectare estate with its enigmatic buildings, believed to hide symbols related to alchemy, masonry, the Knights Templar, and the Rosicrucians. Who knows what sort of eldritch secrets are hidden within these beautiful stone walls? The architecture of the palace evokes Roman, Gothic, Renaissance, and Manueline architecture styles. The construction of the current estate commenced in 1904, and most of it was concluded by 1910. The gardens are incredibly and equally ornate as well. Set on a hillside, a multitude of fountains, grottos, statues, caves, and ponds are all connected both above ground via lovely paths and by a series of underground tunnels lit today by strings of fairy lights. The grounds also include a chapel and an aquarium, built to look as if it naturally existed amongst the rock.